Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and that is National Afghan Dance Music. To introduce our show today with Robert Abdulhai Dar. Welcome. It's great to have you with us again.
It's great to be back.
Well, we have had some wonderful conversations in the past on our show, and today we're going to do something similar. We're going to broaden out the picture of Afghanistan so that our listeners know that there's more to that country than simply war.
Well, I'm delighted.
Robert Abdulhai Dar has been going in and out of Afghanistan for at least 3 decades now.
Yes.
You know the languages, you know the culture, you know the people, you know the religion, you have, you're a convert yourself. And we're going to talk about all of that in the context of Afghanistan today.
I'd be happy to do that.
But I first do want to start off with the latest about the war. Let's
yes.
do that first. In the New York Times, I always read the New York Times because it gives the mainstream message that the administration, everybody wants us to understand.
Yes.
And here we're learning that the latest strategy in Afghanistan to help the anti-Taliban militants in the hope of prompting a large-scale rebellion against the Taliban. This plan is called the Community Defense Initiative, and it brings together thousands of gunmen to protect their neighborhoods from Taliban insurgents. The idea, according to an American official speaking anonymously, is to, quote, get people to take responsibility for their own security. Americans say they'll keep the group small, they'll limit their scope to protecting villages and manning checkpoints. The strategy is similar to the one apparent in Iraq called the Sunni Awakening, although it is admitted that Afghan tribes are weaker than those in Iraq. What do you think of the strategy?
Well, let me say that I'm not at all surprised that the Pashtun tribes are starting to revolt, to some measure anyway, again, to some extent, against the Taliban, because the Pashtun tribal structure is ancient, and it's based on a kind of democracy or consensual agreement between the elders of different tribes, and it has a different value system fundamentally than the Taliban beliefs, which are based really on the changes that we've seen taking place in Islam during the last 5 decades. So fundamentally, what the difference is that the Taliban are trying to bring to the region a kind of Islam that would take precedence over the old tribal system, which is more about the actual tribal values as well as the Islamic values of the Pashtun people. And so it's in the last 5 years, what we've seen is the assassination of many tribal elders. And this, of course, was bound to mainly take place in the Pashtun area because the Taliban are mainly from the Pashtun ethnicity. So the Taliban are, Talib means student, and there were religious students who went to the madrasas, who were preaching a kind of blended Wahhabi and Deobandi religion. And those Talibs, the plural is Taliban, they are mainly Pashtun people. And so you see, it's actually a threat to Pakhtunwali. Pakhtunwali is the ancient Pashtun tribal code, which, by the way, of course, is grounded in Islam. All Afghans, or 99% of Afghans, are Muslim. But the the Pakhtunwali, the Pashtun tribal code, is not identical to Islam. There are fundamental differences. And honor and bravery would be fundamental. And the Taliban are seen as actually, just as we call them cowardly, they are also seen in large measure as tricky and cowardly by many Pashtun tribal elders. So for various reasons, what we're seeing is on a small scale, really, at this point, both in Pakistan, we heard about this a few months ago, and now we're hearing about it in Afghanistan, we're seeing a tribal opposition in some places to the Taliban. And it's not at all surprising that we would see it in non-Pashtun areas, because those people, whether they be Tajik or Hazara or Uzbek, they do not want to be dominated by the Pashtun Taliban. But I think what's more interesting to the administration is that in the Pashtun areas, and this is why they're comparing it to the Sunni awakening, because in that model, as you recall, the Iraqis, who had their own ancient tribal structure and religious values, felt that Al-Qaeda was not Islamic, was in fact extremist from the point of view of the religion. So I've always felt that if we would leave them alone, meaning if we would leave the Islamic world alone, they would sort this out, not only for themselves, but they would sort this out for us at far less cost in human life on that side and on our side, let alone far less cost to our economies, which are bearing the tremendous burden of these wars that we've brought to those regions unnecessarily, giving energy and strength to the Taliban and to Al-Qaeda.
Why do we have the sense that we can go in there and do it, or that we need to change it, or that the system there is not working?
I think we have a fundamental ignorance about the Islamic world that I'm not sure is getting cleared up with all of the media hype and all of the stories. We do find that people have a better sense of who's who in the region. They know who the Taliban are. They know who the Sunni awakening are in Iraq. And in the case of Afghanistan, they know now who the different tribal groups are. But they don't know enough to have confidence in what the Afghans have confidence in, including, by the way, the younger generation, that ultimately something that doesn't fit won't stick. And the extremist values and views of the Taliban might even gain power temporarily, but they won't be able to keep power, because the Afghans are a tribal people who love music, who love gathering and socializing and living in ways that are contrary to Taliban values, contrary to Wahhabist, Deobandist values. So if you understand Afghan culture well enough, you know that Afghans are generally conservative as far as their religious values. And we have to accept that. That's how they are. The majority of the men and women of Afghanistan, compared to us, are God-fearing and in favor of, by our standards, fairly conservative religious values. But those values are very liberal compared to Taliban values or Wahhabi-style values, which call for constant bloodshed and purging society of so-called deviants from their version of the Islamic faith. So if we just had faith in that process, meaning that their that their values, both tribal and religious, are strong enough to expel the Taliban threat over time. I think, and by the way, let me say, I think that also goes for Iran. If we just had faith, like what we're seeing happening right now in Iran, if we just would not interfere and leave them alone, we would see that Iran will be able to resolve its own problems to their own advantage and to the advantage of the Western world.
Sometimes I think that the word that we trip up on is this word tribal.
Yes.
We don't have a real understanding of that word. And having grown up in South Africa, I know that it comes along with a lot of a sense of underdevelopment.
Yes.
So can we talk about the word tribal and how...
Yes, I'd be happy to. I was once taken to task by someone at a university when I was speaking about this, and they said, well, why don't you call your own people tribal? There's something demeaning about that word. And my reply was that they call themselves tribal, and the word qaum, which they use, is it, and they're proud of it, meaning being tribal means having an identity that you're proud of and you want to preserve. If you go online and you look under Pashtun or Tajik, you will see just how proud these various tribes are, and you will also see the competition between them. And I'm afraid some of it is not pretty. I mean, anyone in the West can go online now and see for themselves that these tribes have lived uneasily with each other for hundreds of years. And once in a while, violence erupts when someone takes advantage of those differences between those tribes. And sometimes it's a particular ruler, and sometimes it's an external power. Most Afghans believe that the problems with these tribes have occurred because of outside influence. But the tribes themselves, you can see them described by Herodotus in his history. So this would be 500 years, roughly speaking, before, or several hundred years before the time of Alexander, who was one of the first conquerors to see some defeats in Afghanistan. And already they're describing tribes, highly independent people, who therefore make very effective warriors, very hard to control because there are so many tribes and sub-tribes. It's not ever going to be like Vietnam with a Ho Chi Minh, because there's never going to be unity in Afghanistan. But that's also what prevented the Soviet Union and the Americans now from infiltrating some hierarchy that simply doesn't exist in Afghanistan.
I'm trying not to be simplistic about the way I think about it. Is there a way, can you draw a parallel in our culture to help? Understand.
Well, the only parallel I can think of would be in our own society, perhaps at one level, we could say, well, tribes would be like gangs in the negative sense. Mm-hmm. Meaning, if we were thinking of that word tribe, we can understand tribal behavior because it's been described to us for several generations by sociologists and anthropologists. And there appears to be a human tendency to tribalize, to feel that their lives are meaningful and significant by pulling into smaller groups that can find meaning in their lives and find an identity. Now, at the worst level, as I said, it might be gangs, because we associate that clearly. They're wearing different clothing. They do often resort to violence. There may be other things about them. So in other words, it's a pejorative if you were to say somebody's
right.
Tribal.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to distinguish is that we might also, there's nothing quite like the Afghan sense of tribalism here, because ours is a culture that melts tribes. We're called the melting pot. and you come here to have your tribe melted away from you. They don't want you to have a tribe here. They want maybe the tribes here, the big powerful tribes, would be the corporations. But in
good point.
Yes, and so you see, you have somebody trying to take your identity and sort of, in the case of the corporations, you're not really deriving the kind of benefit that, say, Afghans derive from their tribal identity. Mm-hmm. The Afghan people are a strong, really strong, resourceful, and resilient people because they do live a tribal life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, growing up in South Africa, we had the Zulu people around
yes.
us, and it was the same thing.
Must be the
very,
same thing.
Very
the
strong.
Proud, yes.
Right,
yeah.
Very
it's
proud.
Not a pejorative at all.
Right. At the same time, though, I'm thinking now as we get into the kind of economic straits that we are in this country, there actually is a lot of positive things that come from tribes. I think of them more as neighborhoods or communities.
Yes, I think that's accurate.
Yeah.
To some extent. To some extent,
extent yeah. Because we can at least, we know who one another is.
Yes.
We can participate in the functioning of the group or the community easier.
Yes.
So there's a lot to be said for the tribe, if we can find the right word, to work in the United States, for example.
Yes, well, part of it would be the political divide that has never been more extreme between whether we say Democrat, Republican, or on a more local level, people on the right, people on the left, or people of different shades. But when you look at the national discourse, it's really very heated. And that is reminiscent of what I've seen in places like Afghanistan, where one of the unfortunate aspects of tribe or tribalism is projection. And one projects the negative onto the other. It's one of the fringe benefits of being in a tribe. You can clear away negativity by imposing it upon your neighbor or on the other.
Mm.
And so that's a problem, and it's a problem anywhere that there's tribalism. It sort of reflects self. Same thing with an individual projecting onto others prevents that person from improving themselves by looking more closely at their own faults. And the tribe is like a collective self that's just small enough to be more like a human being than these neighborhoods, or larger neighborhoods rather, of political groups. I think you're right that smaller neighborhoods in cities, like or in the Bay Area where we live, where we have very kind of wonderful tribes of, you know, literati or musicians or political people or activists or people working for the environment, who are all very passionate the way that anyone from a tribe is.
Let's talk about a particular group of people. Now, I'm not sure if we would call them a tribe or not, but the Hazara.
Yes.
And to start that off, let's play a piece of music. This one is called the Hazara Song.
Yes.
Ah
can we say, what can we learn about the Hazara? Is it a tribe? Is it a group? How do they fit into the larger picture of Afghanistan?
Well, again, if we use their word, qaum, to describe the translation of that word, could only be tribe, or possibly someone might translate it as ethnic group. And in the case of the Hazara, there's immediately a visual difference, is they appear to be more Mongolian looking, because in fact they appear to come from further north, from the time of the Mongol hordes, is sort of the main story. The Hazara means the thousand who might have been settled there by Genghis Khan. Mm-hmm. But you immediately see a difference in ethnicity. And they regard themselves certainly as a tribe. They're one of the most united of the tribes, meaning as a people, as an ethnicity. So here we could distinguish among the Pashtuns, which is a large ethnic group, there are many tribes. They have many different tribes and sub-tribes. I mean in the dozens and hundreds. In the Hazarajat, which is the land of the Hazaras themselves have divisions, but they are less noticeable and they're more united. And one reason is they suffered genocide under the last Taliban regime. Literally, thousands of them were killed for no reason. And they have a long history of being subjugated, sold into slavery. And I think this has made them more united. I traveled there in the late 1980s in the Hazarajat, and it was one of the most beautiful places I'd ever seen. It's where the Buddhas were before they were blown up. So everybody knows about the Buddhas at Bamiyan. Bamiyan is sort of the capital of the Hazarajat. The people are wonderful people with a slightly different culture, but they, if I were to describe them and compare them to the other people in Afghanistan, I would say that they are one of the tribes or peoples the most ready for change. And the proof of that is Bamiyan has a woman mayor, and it is the only region in the country that has a woman governor, is the Hazarajat. Mm. So that's a huge step, kind of an unheard of step in a country like Afghanistan, at least today. There always were women in parliament in the old Afghanistan. But for a woman to actually be elected as the mayor of the capital, or for a woman to be appointed as governor of the region, shows that they are people who are forward-looking and who are well aware of the problems of being uneducated, of not having good communications with the outside world. They never want to have that happen again. They've suffered genocide. Anyone who suffers genocide is, you know, just terrified at the prospect that that could happen again. And they may be on the verge of experiencing that again, the way things are going in Afghanistan.
Meaning
that the Taliban, if the Taliban do prevail, obviously, they will take control of the Hazarajat again. And why would we believe that the Taliban would have changed their policy, since they're in fact based on this kind of radical Deobandi and Wahhabi Islam? Why would we now believe that they would have become more moderate? There's absolutely no reason to believe that they have moderated in the last few years. Quite the contrary. Before, when they were in power before, there were no suicide bombers. There were no kinds of other... The murders of tribal leaders had not started to the extent that they have started in more recent times. So if anything, I would say that the Taliban, some of them, many of them, have become more radicalized. So for people like the Hazara, for that tribe, since we're talking about that, Afghanistan is as much or more about tribe than anything else. And massacres are not uncommon in Afghan history always based on tribe.
Do you get a sense that there's an understanding from our side, the American side in this war, that this is a possibility for the Hazara people, another genocide?
I think that the Americans, again, have a fundamental problem of blind self-interest. If they were really interested in themselves and others, the administration would look more closely at precisely this kind of problem, which, you don't see this in the news. You don't see that, oh, the Hazaras may soon lose their freedom because the Taliban might take power and start their campaign of genocide against them, which actually would serve the administration well, would it not? But they're so blind to those kinds of problems and more focused on their own more general problem of how they're going to subdue the Taliban or the Pashtun people or how they're going to try to control the opium cultivation, that they don't really seem to focus on what is fundamental and important that could lead to solutions. For example, right now you perhaps know that the Taliban recently, they made a 7-point proposal for peace. I don't see this in the American press very much, do you? It's there maybe, but it should be front page news for weeks running. I mean, this is the main war that we're fighting right now. And the enemy has made a peace proposal. They said they never would do that, but they have done that. Now, I realize the Taliban is not, again, a monolith. It's actually split into segments, but the main one that we always associate with the origin of the Taliban, which is headed by Mullah Omar, they have made a 7-point proposal. And one of the things that's possible in that proposal is to negotiate precisely things like we're talking about now for the first time. If we leave, what will happen to the other tribal groups? How will you sign a treaty that ensures the safety and human rights of those other tribal groups and not impose your own particular religious values? See, the Hazaras, of course, are Shia, and that's a bit, and they're Ismaili. So that, in other words, they're heretics in the eyes of the Taliban. Now, if we're going to pull out of Afghanistan or make some kind of negotiated settlement, what's going to happen to people who are defined as heretics by the Taliban? And a heretic, don't forget, in their worldview, can be executed. In other words, you're given a choice, convert or die, convert or be imprisoned, usually convert or die in the case of the Hazaras. So, I mean, this is a very serious problem, but there's an opportunity. One has to first be aware of the problem and aware of the peace proposal and decide whether it's to be taken seriously. I'm surprised that the Obama administration hasn't been talking more about how they might open third party, you know, I mean, maybe in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere, actually start peace talks, kind of like what happened in Vietnam, as you recall, in Paris many years ago. There were peace talks started just for discussion. They were just like a kind of a forum where members of the Taliban or people representing them and members of the United States actually started a conversation. And it was a public, or semi-public conversation where people knew that these discussions were going on, there were exchanges taking place. The Taliban seem to be ready for that now. By all accounts, it seems to me Obama is going to go with some kind of a troop surge, which I think is just insane.
There's so much to talk about, and I want to just remind our listeners that we're talking with Robert Abdulhai Dar. We're going to switch over to some of your poetry also.
Oh, thank you.
But before we do that, I want to remind our listeners that, of course, this is Raising Sand Radio at KZSU FM 90.1. And we recently did an interview with Con Hallinan, a local writer, who actually goes into some detail about this 7-point plan that has been presented by the Taliban, and I urge our listeners to go and listen to that if they haven't done so yet, because I think you're right, there's a lot going on that's just not hitting the news.
Yes.
But Robert Abdul Haidar, you are also a writer and a translator, and I'd like to switch over to some of your poetry.
Well, thank you.
Can you share some of that with us?
Yes, I'd be happy to. What I'll do is read a selection or two from a book that inshallah is coming out in the spring called Clarifications. And Clarifications is a book of poetry from the Masnavi by the great and now famous poet Rumi. And what I've tried to do is focus on those poems that have to do with his methodology, which is the Sufi way, and which hopefully give the reader some insight into his approach, through which he came to gain many of the insights and ideas that he had. So I'll read to you, I'll start with a poem called A Mirror for Joseph's Beauty. So Joseph in the Quran represents beauty, beauty of character and human beauty. And so Joseph is really kind of sort of the symbol of God. I mean, he's a human being, he's a prophet in Islam. And of course, we know him from the Old Testament and from Christian literature. But in the Quranic literature, he represents everything that's good in a human being. So he represents the godly person, or the spiritual person on earth. Joseph said, "Come bring your gift." His embarrassed friend groaned at this. He said, "I looked everywhere for a gift, but never saw one that would suit you. How shall gold dust be taken to the mine? How shall a drop of water be brought to the gulp? It's like bringing cumin seed to Kirman if I bring my heart and soul to you. There is no grain not already in this silo, except, of course, your peerless beauty. I saw it right to bring you a mirror, like a light within the breast, for you to view your own face's beauty, O you like the sun, the lamp of heaven. I brought you a mirror, O radiant light. May you think of me when you gaze in it." He pulled the mirror from his side to occupy it with lovely beauty. What is the mirror of being, non-being? If you're not a fool, bring non-being. Being can appear within non-being, just as the rich are generous to the poor. A hungry one is the pure mirror of bread, just as tinder is the mirror of steel and flint. Wherever non-being and lack arise, they're a mirror for the grace of all art. Now this poem, obviously it has some unfamiliar sort of sentiments from a Western point of view, but the basic idea in Sufism is that individuality as we know it is a very constricted kind of existence. Obsessed sort of with itself, obsessed with its own separate identity. So selfhood, meaning for most people, is a kind of a trap, kind of a limitation. It's a bit like the tip of the iceberg jutting above the sea, and there's something 1,000 times more massive that's hidden. And that thing that is hidden is for Rumi this selflessness or non-being or surrender or going into the darkness or going into the silence. So in his approach to Sufism, the whole methodology is a bit like the Platonic unforgetting. In other words, it's the idea is that we're so full of our current experience that we have forgotten something huge about ourselves. And the process is actually a process of going into that non-being that where we came from. So it sounds a little bit mysterious, and maybe the next poem will help us a little bit more. It sort of picks up with the same idea, the mirror. The human form is like good iron. Your outer form is dark as iron. Scour it, polish it. Polish, don't stop. Until your heart becomes a mirror in which to gaze on beauty. Though the iron was dark with no light, polishing scoured away that darkness. The iron's polishing brightened its face, which could then reveal lovely images. The earthly body is dense and dark, so polish it, for it too will brighten. Shapes that were hidden become visible, reflections of angels and celestial beauties. God bestowed the polishing of intellect in order to brighten your heart's sacred scroll. You've stopped polishing, O prayerless one. You've stretched your hands towards desire. If those desires were bound and restrained, your polishing hands would reach out again. The iron that mirrors the unseen world and reveals the images of spiritual messengers was darkened by you. You've let it rust. You've muddied the water. Don't make it worse. Stop churning the water. Let it clarify enough to show the moon and stars circling in it. People are like river water when it's stirred. The water's cloudiness conceals the depths. The depths are full of gems and pearls. It's the finest purity, so don't stir up the mud. The human spirit is like the atmosphere, which hides the sky when full of dust. It even prevents our seeing the bright sun. But when the dust leaves, it's pure and clear. With the perfecting of darkness, God displays his signs, and you travel the road to salvation. So that gives you maybe a better idea of his view. So there's a sense that our individual personality, the kind of tightness that we feel very often, especially in the West, with our sense of individualism and personal lives, that very hard for people to break out of, is sort of the bonds that keep us from experience just how vast we are as beings, which for Rumi, the human being is an instrumentation. It is like a hologram of the whole universe, is really what he thinks. That the universe, for Rumi, emerges not just out of the Big Bang, which is an explosion of matter, but for Rumi, there is awareness at the outset, that the universe is made of awareness. And that awareness becomes trapped in these little tight bundles called ourselves. And if one can just break out of the self, one can re-experience the awareness that the universe is made of.
It's a big job.
Yes. Well, it sounds like a big job,
well, it's
but
even
it's
hard
also
to
the
talk
simplest.
About.
It's actually from the point of view of Sufism, it's also the easiest job. It's just a matter of letting go of what we know. So that first poem was about how to let go of who we think we are. And incidentally, there's nothing alien in what Rumi says to say the views of Taoism or the views of, say, Zen Buddhism. For example, the great Zen poet and mystic Dogen says, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to awaken within the 10,000 things. It's exactly the same idea. They're not preaching a doctrine. They're talking about a methodology. They're talking about experience. They're talking about something they've come to know, like, let's say, a lover who had fallen in love and was trying to explain that either to children or to intellectuals who had never experienced that before. So they're not proposing a philosophy that one should follow. They're trying to explain what they have experienced. That is, of course, their claim. It's hard for Westerners to grasp this in general, but it's not alien to the old Western tradition, which included mysticism, which, of course, this is what we're now discussing in the case of Rumi. Not the mysticism of pulling the wool over people's eyes, but the mysticism of breaking open the atom of the self to find the shining sun inside, as Shabastari would say. So it's a lovely path, and Rumi, of course, is the great well-known poet of that path, so I decided to do one book just of his teachings. Do you want me to recite one more?
I would like you to recite one more. And also, if you don't mind, after we have another poem, let's talk about your journey into this way of seeing the world.
I'll be happy to do that.
Let me remind our listeners, again, this Raising Sand Radio, talking with Robert Abdul-Haidar.
So this last poem is called Name and Reality. Have you seen a name without its reality? Ever picked a rose from the letters R-O-S-E? You've spoken the name. Now go find the named. The moon is above, you know, not in the water. If you want to pass beyond letters and name, go purify yourself at once from self. Like iron without tarnish, become without feature. In spiritual discipline, become a rust-free mirror. Clarify the self of all self-characteristics in order to discover the pure, clear self-essence. So the heart sees with prophetic knowledge, without books, tutors, and masters. The prophet said, some of my followers are of my essence and spiritual insight. Their spirits see me directly by that light, and I too see them because of it. This all occurs without reliance on scripture, just by drinking the pure water of life.
Purify from self.
Yes, just as Dogen said. So he doesn't mean one's real self. One's real self is the universe, according to this view. As I said earlier, we are like a hologram or a summary or the essence of, or identical to the universe, along with the awareness that is not normally observed in the universe by science. The mystic would say there is an instrument for seeing the awareness of the universe, and that instrument is oneself. But one has to get out of the way of oneself first. So another way that has been described, say, in Taoism, is there's a house, the house of awareness, but the tenant or a usurper has taken over the house and claims that it's theirs. The owner of the house is around, but one has to first get past the usurper or the tenant to meet the owner of the house. Mm. This is a very difficult thing for Westerners because they're so convinced that their persona or their personality or set of personalities is who they really are. And the Sufi would say, it is not that that doesn't have something to do with them, but it is only a small part of human nature, and that human nature is one of the most lovely things imaginable. It is the very substance and essence of the universe.
That was Robert Abdulhai Dar opening up a wider view of Afghanistan with music and poetry. Now that President Obama has ordered 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, it behooves us as Americans to understand more about this country before it is way too late. Robert Abdulhai Dar started a conversation today about his journey into Afghanistan, and Raising Sand Radio will continue this conversation in the next week. So tune in, and we'll talk much more deeply about Sufism. Next week, we'll talk with Nadia Tarzi, founder and executive director of Association for the Protection of Afghan Archaeology, and she's also the daughter of Dr. Zemuralai Tarzi, who is excavating the reclining Buddhas in the Bamiyan Valley and other sites in Afghanistan. You may not know, or you may indeed know, that Afghanistan is the most looted country in the world today. Its antiquities disappearing before scientists even have a chance to record what it is the world community is losing. Join us for that show next week. And Raising Sand Radio is on the road for the next 3 months. We'll be bringing you news and views from Southern Africa and the Middle East, and we hope to bring you lots of voices of people from those regions to help, again, broaden our understanding of what is going on in these regions. As usual, views and opinions are those of the host and guests, and not KZSU or Stanford University. Please go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, to listen to other shows, and if you want to contact me directly, you can do so at susan@raisingsandradio.org. Let's go out with a melody for flute from Turkestan.
خبردار خاص وان، خبردار خاص وان.